2. Heyday, 1976 to 1980. By the beginning of its second season, Saturday Night Live was the talk of television, a national sensation both hot and cool, and the first hit any network ever had at 11:30 on Saturday night. Chevy Chase had become a star and flown the coop, though he would continue to make the occasional cameo appearance. Some cast members and writers saw his leap into greener pastures as tantamount to treason, but it kept SNL from turning into the Chevy Chase Show and cleared the way for John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, Gilda Radner, Lorraine Newman, Garrett Morris, and others to become the kind of household name that Chevy had managed virtually overnight. The Muppets were gone. Short films by Gary Weiss and Tom Schiller would replace those of Albert Brooks. NBC censors were virtually forced by the program's surging popularity to become less strict. This was well before people could say pissed off or that sucks on television. And as other programs took advantage of the liberation, a new candor and a new realism came to American TV, for better and sometimes for worse. The way people talked on television was becoming closer to the way people talked in everyday life. A long-time boundary was being erased. Today, one hears language in primetime sitcoms and even commercials that was unthinkable on early editions of Saturday Night Live. In time, the show would break the penis and vagina barriers, among many others. They couldn't fully know it at the time, but the cast, writers, and producers of Saturday Night Live were living through the program's golden age from 1975 to 1979, the era of the original cast, with Bill Murray replacing the departed Chevy Chase, the founding writers, and occasional visits from such off-the-wall novelties as quixotic comic Andy Kaufman and Mr. Bill, a little clay man who each week would be mauled and mangled. This was a time of exuberance, adventurousness, and unbridled excess. It would become legendary and infamous, and set standards by which every subsequent manifestation of the show, including all future casts, would be judged. Lorraine Newman, cast member. There was one point in the second season where we were on stage rehearsing a nerd sketch or something, and we were all talking about what we were naming our corporations. And I think it was Gilda who said, "Listen to us, for God's sake. We're talking about our corporations. What's happened? We've joined the establishment." And we were really kind of being hurled into all the trappings of a successful adult life at a young age.
Tom Hanks, host. It was the cultural phenomenon of the age. It was truly as big as the Beatles. It was this huge, riotous thing, and it was on every week, and everybody gathered together on Saturday nights to watch it. We would get together in college, and then, later on, when I was working in the theater, we would all get together after shows at a house and watch. Everybody from the theater that I was working at in Cleveland was in the living room of this rented house, watching a 10-inch black-and-white television with a coat hanger for an antenna. And that's just what you did every week. Got together and had something to eat, and sat around waiting for Saturday Night Live to come on. Brian Doyle Murray, cast member. The show felt like it was the center of the universe. There was such a clamor about it. People at parties would stop and turn on the show and watch it. So it felt like the big high point of TV. Half your job seemed like arranging for tickets for people you knew. James Signorelli, director of commercial parodies. By the autumn of the second year, I remember walking around with Gilda and not being able to go 50 feet down the street without people stopping us warmly and saying, "Hi, I love you, and I love your stuff," and so on. At first, Gilda was pleased and delighted, and then later, much later, felt kind of put upon. Tom Schiller, writer. There were all kinds of people, like Mike Nichols, who thought the show was hip, and Norman Mailer, and you'd see them at restaurants, and they'd nod to you and stuff, and you thought you were so great. And then some nights you would come out of the show and you would see these really strange, geeky people with 8x10s and marking pens to have you sign your autograph. And they were like troglodytes, these people. They were strange people who were your fans. So it was hard to reconcile who really liked you.
Robin Schlynn, production assistant. You would look around and Jerome Robbins would be in the back of the control room one night, or Michael Bennett. It was this place where the toasts of the town would show up.
Alan Zweibel, writer. To this day, I look back on those first 5 years with incredible fondness. I tend to romanticize the experience because it was way more good than bad, but when it was bad, it was very painful. It was very, very painful.
Jane Curtin, cast member. I loved doing the 90 minutes of the show, just loved it, but I couldn't do the other stuff. I couldn't be in the writers' meetings. It was too frustrating. I just didn't function well in that situation. I didn't know how to push my ideas, so I would come in for the read-through on Wednesday and then go straight home. On Thursday, when I came to work on time. In the second season, I had Update, so I had something to do on the show and didn't have to fight to be on the air. Update was my anchor. Everything else was gravy. The nerds, I loved those sketches. I loved working with Buck and Billy and Gilda, and we always laughed because they were just so dumb. And sometimes things like the Why Debts, because they would just make you hysterical. And I loved the epics and the costume dramas, and some of the talk shows that we did were just yummy. There were a lot of other things, but the fact that I had Update and didn't have to plead for material kept me sane. I had the luxury of being able to leave and come in when I needed to. I didn't hang around, and so I approached it from a totally different point of view than I think anybody else. Rosie Schuster, writer. Those first 5 years, only Jane amongst the cast was really able to have a total personal life. I think a few of the guys maybe could have someone back home. Of the girls, you lived and slept and breathed the show. You stayed there. I remember Danny and I, after sleeping over at the office, would walk each other like dogs around 30 Rock just to get a little fresh air. In those first years, it was just pure gonzo, total commitment. There was this phenomenon that was exploding, and we all threw ourselves into it 200%. The whole thing sort of marked the beginning of comics being thought of the way rock stars had been. The rock stars had that real pulsing energy and immediacy. And this particular show, because of its live New York danger vibe, gave you that same kind of raw immediacy. It was just raggedy ass a lot of times.
Paul Simon, host. I don't think they necessarily changed for the worse with that metamorphosis into success. They became more confident. And they were still young, so that they hadn't burned out and weren't cynical yet. Maybe they had more offers and distraction. That might have been a negative, I don't know. But they weren't jaded. Bill Murray, cast member. I remember my very first show. I had a sketch that was a little tricky to do, a telephone sketch. They were making me up for the first time, and they were trying to make me look old, and, well, you don't feel really comfortable the first time they make you look old. I was 25 or 26, and they're trying to make you look like you're 75, and it plays a little on your confidence. There was like a committee of people going, maybe if you put some gray in his temples, and you're thinking, oh my God, we're going to be in trouble out here. But that's one that I sort of pulled together on the air. I read it well the first time in the read-through, but you're not thinking about what it looks like, and even in rehearsals, it's like you're still Bill, you know? My confidence sort of dropped, because I thought, this isn't really helping me. So I had to do it two times that day, the run-through and the dress rehearsal and that makeup. Then for the air, there was still that put some gray in his temples business. And at a certain point, about 40 seconds before I had to do it, I just said, that's enough, stop. And I just walked away, and it was just on me to make it work. So I made that one work. That was pretty successful. I did 3 shows, and they were on a look-see basis. I think they hired me for 3 shows, and I remember just walking out onto the street after the first show, and Lauren said, "I guess you're going to be moving to New York." And it felt great, you know, it felt really good. And so I thought, this is great, I did it. But then I didn't get any sketches for weeks after that. That's when I became the second cop. Most of the rest of the year I played the second cop in sketches. That speech I did to the audience, the one where I said, "I don't think I'm making it on the show," that was during my second cop period. I'd really been there a pretty long time, and they were sort of stuck with me. I was there, they'd sort of hired me, I was getting paid, but I was playing that second cop every week. You sort of have to break through, be noticed by the audience. They have to understand you a little bit, see a little bit of who you are. But as the second cop, you don't really get those opportunities. I'd actually had the idea to do something exactly like what it was, and that day when I went to work, Lauren said, "You know, I think you should do a direct appeal." He had the same idea, too. So I did this thing. I wrote the thing, and it was kind of funny, and I wasn't too full of myself or anything. There was a couple tablespoons of humility in it. I got laughs in it, and I think the combination of the two broke some sort of ice, not just for me, but for people watching, and they thought, well, okay, he's going to be funny. He made us laugh with that sort of I'm dying here thing, which I've seen people do and die at. You know, I've seen people make that move before and fail. So the fact that I made that move and it was funny sort of took the pressure off. I felt pretty good about that. And it is sort of a funny watershed. It's a moment. Robert Klein, host. I had hosted during the first season, but the next time I was on the show wasn't until the 3rd season, in 77. And Lorne called me into the office that time and said, "You know, a lot has changed since you hosted. The kids have become celebrities. Stars, you know, and the host is just one of the gang now." I said, I understood that fully. But the real difference was Belushi. He was a changed person. There was a lot of difficulty rehearsing with him.
Jane Curtin. When John started making too much money and started doing too many drugs, the sweet John was gone, and the ambitious John took over. And that's what was difficult to deal with. His ambition was just overwhelming, as was his need to self-medicate.
Steve Martin, host. Once, when it was very late after the show and everybody was in their limos and we were on, like, 72nd Street or something, Belushi got out of the car in the middle of the night and stood in the street screaming and directing traffic and being funny. And I thought, oh... There was something about it that was forced. I remember feeling like John felt he had to do this stuff. It was what he wanted to be. He also did things that were unforced, but at that moment he was trying to fulfill an image.
Carrie Fisher, host. I was hanging around with Belushi, though Lord knows how I got to him. Everybody kind of knew each other. These were people who were abusers. People who like to drink and use and stay up all night. Once you got into that little society, you were well in. Danny used to call John the black hole in space, because if anything got near him, it disappeared into it. And he was also America's guest, because he could literally go to anybody's apartment or house, and did, and say, "Hi, can I use your kitchen or your bathroom or your bedroom? Or your anything?" John was always kind of a little bit of an emergency happening, but a fun emergency. At that time, I don't think anyone had said to me yet, "If John keeps this up, he will die." That was like 2 years away. It wasn't that dark.
Herb Sargent, writer. I happened to be the one who broke the news to Belushi that Elvis had died. He had wandered into my office, there were just the two of us, and I told him I'd just heard it on the news, and he just froze for 10 minutes. He didn't move, he couldn't talk, nothing. John Landis, film director. I've seen this attributed to John Lennon, but I know Michael O'Donohue said it because I was there when we heard Elvis died. My secretary came in and she said, "Elvis is dead." And Michael O'Donohue said, "Good career move."
Judith Belushi, writer. John apologized a lot. He knew when he was wrong, and I think that he always came back and made sure to do that. He had a childlike way of seeing things, which is what I think artists and comedians need. He'd see things fresh. He'd see the thing that everyone is looking at a little differently.
Dan Aykroyd, cast member. John would watch tape on whoever he was impersonating. He was meticulous in the preparation in terms of wardrobe, hair, makeup. He was always concerned with doing an accurate impression. He was very well-read in English and history and theater. He counted among his friends Lauren Bacall and Judge Jim Garrison, and he was a student of American politics. John just astounded me with his references to English literature, American literature, history, politics. He was so well-versed in things that you would never expect. He was a football star when he was a kid, an all-American guy, Albanian blood, and his father had an accent, his mother had an accent. But to me, he was totally all-American. He was extremely bright, really, really smart, a great administrator and executive. When we were doing our Blues Brothers thing, he was clearly in charge. He was the front man. He was the boss. He was the guy that was calling the shots. Everything was brought to him for decisions, and ultimately his decisions were the correct ones. He was very together as a businessman, understood the creative world and the business world, and the marriage between the two. He was just one of the smartest people I have ever met.
Marilyn Suzanne Miller, writer. If you look at The Samurai, if you look at the Beethoven piece he did, there's no plethora of words. A lot of times, he's doing a lot of acting. He's just acting all over the place. But he's not using words to do it. I wrote a piece where he crossed over into using words, and he was brilliant. The piece is a really great piece about this young couple who are having trouble with their sex life, and the guy can't get it up because he secretly believes she's thinking about somebody else. And John was so bound and determined to get every fucking word. That's what was so great about it. He was really acting, and he was really using words. That was proof that John Belushi was meant to live to be a great actor. I cried at the end of it, because it was so thrilling.
Al Franken, writer. On one of the shows where Belushi played Fred Silverman, he was like totally out of it, almost unable to perform. I remember it very, very well, because I was one of the writers of the sketch. Between dress and air, I went with another writer, Jim Downey, to John's dressing room. I had the script in my hand, and I knocked on the door, and when I went in, I saw that John was kind of out of it, sitting in a chair, and I said, "John, I want to read the script to you so that when you say the lines on air, it sounds familiar." And then he threatened to hit me, at which point Downey started to back out the door. But I knew John would never hit me. He just wouldn't do it. So he held his fist up, and I just read him the sketch, and then I left. And it was marginally better on air.
Judith Belushi. I don't remember John ever hitting anyone. I tried to punch him once, though. It was very aggravating, because he was like a fellow that you really cared about and you could see him hurting himself. You'd see him sinking, and it made you want to say, "Stop it now, or I'll stop you."
Lorne Michaels, executive producer. One of the things you realize after a while is you can be having a talk about whatever you're thinking is important or matters with a comedian, and more likely than not, he's just getting an impression of you down. You think it's about the content of what you're saying, but they're just sort of seeing your lips move and going, "Oh, he holds his head like that." It's like people caricaturing you, but you don't see the drawing. So John Belushi used to have heart-to-heart talks with people, particularly when they were talking about drugs. And they'd say, "I had a really, really good talk with John." And no, John was using his time in another way. He'd already heard the content of that message. Al Franken. Yes, there were some people on the show doing coke. I don't like to get into this. John died of it. He had a problem. He got addicted. We didn't know about that. We didn't know at the time. When I say we, I mean Americans didn't know what cocaine did, and about addiction, and that kind of thing. Dan Aykroyd. The powders and the pills were never attractive to me. It was just John. One of the nights, when he played Silverman, that was pure blow. Pure blow, yeah. It made me angry. God knows I poured a lot of it down the toilet. But there were times when he was clean, and then, of course, there were times when he was at his peak. You know, the Joe Cocker stuff. And he really took the work seriously. It's just that he had an addiction. He would also get screwed up on painkillers. We were doing a lecture in Rhode Island once, and he jumped off the stage and shattered his shin. It was a Catherine the Great sketch, and he had a long, long wig. He was really fucked up that day. Richard Dreyfuss, host. I remember that during the final dress rehearsal, John Belushi couldn't stand up. He'd been, like, falling around and mumbling and forgetting everything. I thought, oh boy, this won't be great. He'll never make it through this show. Then the show came around, and he was perfect. He was incredible, and I remember being astounded by that, because at the time I was very admiring of anyone who could take drugs better than I could. Bill Murray. John was great. John was very good to all of us. He was tough on the hosts, though. The better an actor the host was, the sicker Belushi would be. He would be at death's door. He would be hours late, and at death's door, and he would come in a robe, unable to speak. He'd have doctors in his dressing room. It would be just incredible. And the host would be thinking, Belushi isn't even going to show up. He's too sick even to work. And then John would come out on the show and just blast them away. He would sucker-punch guys that just didn't see it coming. And the more actorish they were, the worse they got it. If it had been someone who'd won an Academy Award or something, they didn't have a chance, and you knew it. Somebody would write a great sketch for them, and Belushi would be in it, and he'd rehearse it at sort of like 40%, too sick to really work, coughing into Kleenexes and pockets full of Kleenex. They'd be out there on the set waiting to rehearse, and he'd come in assisted and in a robe and looking like hell, barely speaking and coughing the whole time and just completely distracted, just like barely alive. And he'd be that way pretty much through dress. The doctors would be there. You'd be waiting for him during the run-through and the dress rehearsal. You'd smell vaporizers from his room. He had the smell of Vicks VapoRub and salves and creams and all sorts of medicines. And he would come out and just kill. Just kill. I think he did it to Richard Dreyfuss. He did a Dreyfuss impression the week before Dreyfuss hosted. He did Dreyfuss in The Goodbye Girl. I don't like the panties hanging on the rod. He just hated the performance in the movie, and he did it the week before the guy got there and murdered it, just murdered it. There was no point in warning the host. They had too much anxiety anyway. They'd run to the next sketch going, what happened? What happened to my sketch? He would come out of nowhere off his deathbed, and he was on his deathbed a couple times a year. And, you know, it was, he's been doing the Blues Brothers all week, and he just came back from rehearsal last night, and he hasn't slept. He had the Dr. Feelgood guys there giving him shots and stuff. It was delightful.
Lorraine Newman. We did this one sketch about fishing in Alaska. And right before we went on stage, I was in back of the set with John, and he was green. Just green. I knew he would go on. I just didn't know how long he was going to live.
Tom Schiller. When I started making films for the show, the third one I made was Don't Look Back in Anger, the Belushi in the Cemetery one. It was based on the idea that I can look at people and I can see how they're going to look when they get old. Of course, I didn't know John wasn't going to get old, but I was intrigued with the idea. When he shot it, he did every line perfectly and went to every spot perfectly without even blocking it beforehand. It was shot at some cemetery in Brooklyn. It was creepy. Robert Klein. In a sketch about giant lobsters attacking New York, I played the guy who said, oh, the humanity! Like the radio reporter from the Hindenburg fire. There was a very revealing line in there that was pretty awful when you think about it. Oh, John Belushi is dead. We knew he'd die young, but not this young. Another time, in one sketch we were rehearsing, Belushi had the part of the father. Miscasting, but it was just a sketch. and he was just sort of shaking and quick-tempered and impatient, and finally we were almost going to hit each other. And Aykroyd breaks it up and calms everything down quickly and says, "Oh, I'll do the part." It was like a terrible flare-up, a very bad memory, and Aykroyd, ever the mensch, stepped in and settled everything. And it was nothing permanent with Belushi and me, but I do recall in subsequent weeks Belushi was off the show. I call it getting docked, like at camp or something, where you're being punished. This is another of Lorne Michaels's talents that I'll have to give him, that he was able to juggle this stuff. Because there were drugs around. There were cocaine lines the length of a desk, you know? And most people could handle it. But a few people fell very badly through the cracks.
Jane Curtin. Lorne and I stopped speaking. It was during the second year. He wouldn't answer my questions. I would say, "Why aren't you doing something about John? I found him going through my purse. He set your loft on fire. His behavior is reprehensible. He's not coming to rehearsals, or if he does come, he comes 3 hours late. Do something." And he didn't. He would just sort of throw his hands in the air. Lorne doesn't deal with issues. Lorne cannot confront an issue. So I thought, well, this is pointless. I'm not going to talk to him anymore. Gilda became our go-between. When Lorne wanted me to do something, he would call Gilda and say, "Would you ask Jane if she would do this?" And Gilda would come up to me and say, "Lorne was wondering if you would mind doing this." And I'd say, "No, that would be fine." This made life so much easier. We would say hello, but beyond that, there was nothing I needed from Lorne. I had Update, so I didn't need anything. I didn't need a father. I had a husband who loved me and a great little dog. Life was good. Kate Jackson, host. I got a phone call from Bob Woodward when he was doing his book Wired, and he wanted to talk to me because he had heard that the show I had hosted was John's worst in terms of drug abuse. I didn't know that, because I never saw anybody do anything, so I didn't talk to Woodward. I heard later that paramedics had been called over to the studio and were standing by for John all through the show. But John didn't miss the show. He was perspiring a little bit. But he never, never went way off on a wrong tangent, never went off the cards, or never messed anything up that made it hard for me to get back on track. He did what he was supposed to do. John called me afterwards. For weeks he would call me on Thursday afternoons just to say hello and to thank me for saving his life. "Wow," he'd say, "Katie, man, you really saved my life. Wow, and thank you." And I frankly don't know what he was talking about. I didn't know why he was calling. He was just so sweet, you know? Danny had told me, "John is a bad boy, but a good man."
Norman Lear, host. I loved in John, and also in Aykroyd, what I loved in Carol O'Connor and B. Arthur. A madness that would allow them to go any place. I have to say, whatever year I'm destined to die, I have 5 or 10 years on top of that, because those people who offered me that touch of madness gave me time added to my life. Neil Levy, production assistant. I was at Catch a Rising Star trying to pick up a girl one night. When I first started on that show, I looked like I was about 12, and this girl didn't believe I worked on Saturday Night Live. And then, suddenly, everyone turned toward the door. Because Belushi had entered. Whenever he entered a room, there was an energy about him that made people turn their heads. And this girl saw him, and John saw me, and he went, "Neil!" and starts coming right toward me. And I'm thinking, this girl is going to be putty in my hands now. And he comes right up to me and gives me a big bear hug and says, "You got any money?" I'm thinking, not only do I know John Belushi, but he's going to borrow money from me. So I take out my wallet, and he takes the wallet out of my hands, rummages through it, hands it back, goes, "Thanks," and disappears into the crowd. Well, he'd left me with $1, and there were no ATMs back then. When I went to find him, he had disappeared. If he did something like that, though, I remember more than one time him coming around later and saying, "Was I with you last night?" And you'd go, "Yeah." And he'd go, "I'm so sorry," and be really contrite. Then you'd hear him knocking on other people's doors and going in to apologize about things. Al Franken. There was not as much cocaine as you would think on the premises. Yeah, a number of people got in trouble, but cocaine was used mainly just to stay up. There was a very undisciplined way of writing the show, which was staying up all night on Tuesday. We didn't have the kind of hours that normal people have. And so there was a lot of waiting till Tuesday night, and then going all night, and at 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning, doing some coke to stay up, as opposed to doing a whole bunch, and doing nitrous oxide and laughing at stuff. People used to ask me about this, and I'd always say, "No, there was no coke. It's impossible to do the kind of show we were doing and do drugs." And so that was just a funny lie that I liked to tell. Kind of the opposite was true, unfortunately. For some people it was impossible to do the show without the drugs. Comedians and comedy writers and people in show business in general aren't the most disciplined people, so the idea of putting the writing off until you had to and then staying up all night was an attractive one. And then having this drug that kept you awake in an enjoyable way was kind of tempting, too. But I only did cocaine to stay awake to make sure nobody else did too much cocaine. That was the only reason I ever did it.
Robin Schlynn. The band scored an ounce of coke on the air one night. According to the band member who told me, they got it during a commercial and divvied it up. I couldn't attest to whether it was gone by the end of the show. The dealer used to be to the left of the stage, and the commercials were a couple minutes long. I thought that was kind of an amazing story.
Tom Davis, writer. Dick Ebersol was the only real network suit who would pop into the offices on 17, and it didn't bother him so much. I remember getting in an elevator with Tom Brokaw once, though, and I was just reeking of pot. Just stinking up the elevator because I had really skunky pot. He couldn't help but notice. He just got very quiet. Everybody on the elevator stopped talking. Brokaw kind of looked at me out of the corner of his eye. I just smiled. "What else are you going to do?" Rodney Dangerfield, host. I never saw anybody do hard drugs there. Pot, sure. Put it this way. I've been smoking pot all my life. I've found it tremendously relaxing. I do it a lot. The doctor told me don't smoke cigarettes, just smoke pot.
Carrie Fisher. Lorne was the token grown-up in a sea of children and co-eds. He was very professorial. He was only rated R while the rest of us were unruly, not well-behaved, but fun-loving. I think he was trying to keep everything together without it looking like that's what he was doing. But certainly he wasn't fully participating in all the drug nonsense. He would look at it and shake his head laughing. That kind of thing. Lorraine Newman. I came there with a drug habit. I'd had a drug habit since I was 14. It just got worse. I never worked intoxicated or high or anything. It was so much a part of me that it just permeated my outlook on things. It was also a very lonely time for me. I was pretty young. I didn't know that many people in New York. I was terribly homesick, and I was frustrated about the amount of airtime I was getting. So those things made me want to escape what I was thinking and feeling a lot. Drugs were very available. That's how I coped. I know they did their damage. Jane Curtin. Lorraine was in a horrible position. She was a baby. She was like 20 or 21, and she was uprooted from this very comfortable lifestyle in L.A. with all her friends, and into New York, where she was in a hostile environment and she was alone. She didn't have any place to put that creative energy, so she had it tough. She was not happy. And I don't blame her, because it's hard enough to do that show in a comfortable environment. But when you're totally at sea, when your surroundings are different and you're just not comfortable, it's extremely hard.
Dick Ebersol, NBC executive. The second year of the original show, I would take John to California with me every Sunday. By then I was married to my first wife, and I would take him home with me on Sunday and bring him back on Wednesday for read-through. And what I didn't know at the time was, my first wife and he, after I fell asleep, nothing romantic about it, but they would go out again. They'd go out all night and just manage to get back before 6 o'clock in the morning when I would wake up. And I woke up one morning at 6 o'clock, still not having doped all of this out, and walk by our guest bedroom, which was smoldering, and John had fallen asleep smoking a joint. Brian Doyle Murray. After I left Second City, John and his wife came to visit, and I had one of those floor heaters, you know, where the heat comes out from a grate on the floor, and they were fooling around on the couch and knocked a pillow on top of it. All of a sudden, I woke up and there was smoke in the house. They didn't even realize that the pillow was on fire.
Penny Marshall, guest. I'd get calls about John in the middle of the night. John just burned down my apartment. John just started a fire, that type of thing. Sometimes he would just knock on my door at 3 in the morning. We'd know when John got up in the middle of the night to eat, because there'd be spaghetti sauce imprints all over the kitchen. Oh, look, John was up. I guess he got hungry. Judith Belushi. The second or third year of the show, we were walking downtown, and there was an empty bar for rent. We got the idea of renting it ourselves. At that time, we actually had a pretty good-sized place on Morton Street, but we didn't want to invite 50 people over. So we thought we'd use this bar as a place to hang out. After the show or other nights, we'd invite people over. We had instruments there, and we kept the bar stocked. For a while, it was pretty crazy. After the show, there was always a Saturday Night Live party. We'd usually go by that for a little while. The hosts would be there and all that. Then, afterward, we'd go to the bar. It was just a big party. The hosts sometimes came down to the bar, but more often musicians, writers, actors, friends, and sometimes even people we didn't know.
Dan Aykroyd. We opened the first blues bar in 77, I think. So for a few years, we had a great place to party after the show. It was pretty easy to get in. You just had to show up and knock on the door. We used to go to the after party for the show, and then we'd take all the writers and our friends and the musical guests and the host of the show and invite them down for a party where you didn't have the public hanging around. Because usually at the after parties, they let the public come in at some point. And we just wanted the inner circle there, so we needed a bar where we could entertain. Robin Williams, host. Years and years and years ago, before I even did the show, I'd come to the studio those nights when they were shooting, and then after they'd go down to the blues bar, way back when. Dan brought me down there the first time. I said, "What is this?" He said, "Just step inside. Don't be afraid, Robin. Just step inside. You'll see there's amazing people, wonderful music. Just step inside." It was like you'd walk in and it was funky. Funky is a good word. The old sense of, was that a rat? Maybe. The rat's going, "Hey, shut up." The crowd was a really mixed bag, you know. A lot of the performers, musicians, Michael O'Donohue, always good for an unusual laugh. And Dan bartending and kind of being maitre d'. A really wild mixed group of people. Brian Doyle Murray. There would always be a party, usually at some she-she restaurant. There was a velvet rope and it was supposedly, you know, the event. Actually, it was usually pretty grim. But Lorne would hold court at a table, usually with whoever the guest host was, and people would hang out in their own little cliques. There would be some talk, you know, about who the good-looking girls were and things like that. But then people would bail out of there and go down to the blues bar, and there'd usually be a band, and Danny and John would be performing, and it was a lot looser atmosphere. Bill Murray. I was one of those blues bar people. Stayed until the sun came up. You had to blow off a lot of steam. You had an amazing performance high that lasted because it had built to this explosive point at an odd hour of a normal person's day, between 11:30 and 1 a.m. You couldn't really just say goodnight and go home and go to sleep. You were up for hours. You had all this energy and this uplift, and you had to sort of work it off. So you could go to the blues bar, where you could dance and you could drink and you could be funny and could meet a lot of people and really carry on. It was necessary to have a place to go. You couldn't just go to an ordinary place because there were a lot of people who would crash into it. You had a very weird energy. It was just a completely different energy after you did that thing. You weren't fit for normal people. You had to go someplace where you could let yourself down gradually. So that was great that they provided this place where you could go and you'd be safe. At any point, if there was someone that was bothering you, every person that was already in was a bouncer. And you'd just say, "You've got to go." And it was kind of funny because they would think they'd just walk away from you like, "Nah, that's all right, man, I won't bother you anymore." "No, no, you're not going to bother anybody else either." And it was a shocking moment when someone would get in and start working it and then get evicted by anybody. The women would just go, "He's out. Danny, Billy, this guy, out." And out he'd go. I know famous people got tossed out, too. Famous people in their own area came, and when they obviously were just sucking blood, they were just evicted. We had no time for that. We were really just trying to get down to a safe level so you could sleep. Because you couldn't really sleep until 6 in the morning, no matter what you did.
Lorraine Newman. When I saw Trainspotting, they had a sign, "The filthiest toilet in Scotland." Well, the toilet at the blues bar was the filthiest toilet anywhere. It was so vile. Nothing short of Turkish torture with a hole in the ground. And the walls had water damage and were peeling and stank unbelievably. The floor was always wet, completely wet, wadded up tissue on the floor. And yet it was a fun hang, a windowless hole with lots of cool music people and the Stink Band, named because they stank too. It would be John and Danny, plus people like David Bowie and Keith Richards and James Taylor. And then they had the backup group, the Natural Queens, one of which was my best friend, Lynn Scott, who is married to Tom Scott, who was in the Blues Brothers band. You'd go in, it was dark. You'd come out, it was dawn. Nothing more depressing than that. If there was sex on the premises, I never saw it. And I shudder to think if it took place in the bathroom. That person couldn't be alive today. It really looked like it had been maybe a bar from the Titanic that had been exhumed after several hundred years of submersion and just hastily dropped onto a sidewalk. It was practically rotting, which is probably how they got it, because the rent was reasonable, and at the time none of us had that much money. We were still getting probably maximum $2,000 a show. I think our fourth season we all got $4,000 a show. We started the first year at $750.